Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Leaving by Roxana Robinson. Every love story needs an obstacle, someone or something that threatens to keep the lovers apart. What obstacles are suitable for a contemporary American love story? The writer of such a story may wish to avoid the over-communication, the tolerance, real or performed, and the jadedness that dispel romantic tension. Can lovers still be star-crossed, doomed from the start to labor under a malign star? They can, says Roxana Robinson in her elegant love story, Leaving. Robinson is the author of 9 previous works of fiction, as well as a biography of Georgia O'Keeffe. Warren and Sarah, 2 60-year-olds who were a couple in their youth, crossed paths at a performance of Tosca. Years ago, Sarah had contemplated marrying Warren, but decided he would be an unwise choice for a mate. The very things that make him charming once he reappears at 60, his enthusiasms, his intense desire for intimacy, scared the young Sarah, and she put her chips on Rob instead. He turned out to be the wrong choice, and the marriage was a washout. When Warren and Sarah run into each other at the opera, they've got unfinished business. The two live contented lives until this encounter. Warren is married, while Sarah, the parent of 2 grown children and long divorced from Rob, is wedded to her woodsy home, her solitude, and her exceptionally human dog. But as the narrative moves smoothly between the two points of view, we watch them become astonished and changed by each other. The affair that follows is mature, even if it is destructive. Sarah, the product of an intensely upper-crust background, is a restrained woman who speaks in self-edited phrases. We appreciate her meta-knowledge of her position. To a friend who endured her own husband's affair, Sarah points out, "I'm the other woman." We don't dislike Warren's wife, Janet, either, but we wouldn't want to be married to her. She's on the goofy side, overly literal, and afraid of people unlike herself. On the other hand, she doesn't deserve Warren's duplicity as he tries to execute his marriage without causing pain. All of the grown-ups in the book are rendered gently. Years after the affair, Warren writes his still furious daughter, "I've done something to damage our relationship, but as you know, I have done everything in my power to atone for what I've done." Atone he does. Turns out it's Kat, Warren's grown daughter, who is this love story's antagonist. When Kat hears that Warren has decided to leave her mother for Sarah, she begs him, "Please don't do it, Dad. You haven't done it yet. Don't. You'll kill us. You'll kill our family." The daughter's pain soon hardens into something more severe. Finally, Kat lays down her terms. "If you divorce Mom, I'll divorce you. I'll divorce you utterly." What follows may strain the credulity of some readers and feel uncomfortably realistic to others. We watch Warren waver in the face of exile from his only daughter. He was a father more than anything, it turned out. He was that first. Kat's demands are outrageous, and yet there is something logical about them. We aren't married to our children, but we are involved in something deeply contractual. We can culturally situate Warren's position as the end result of the current state of parenting, some would say overparenting, that has become the norm of many families with the means and time for it. This intimacy that we had or tried to have with our children has a price and leaves us more bereft without them. A parent of this style cannot retroactively invoke social imperatives of yore, when children were guilted into duty and continued contact. Deep into the book, Leaving feels like a Westchester remix of Chekhov's The Lady with the Dog, another story of adultery with a confrontation at the theater. Robinson's storytelling is classic, page after page of swiftly moving scenes and writing as precise as rows of tilled earth. Robinson reworks the short sentence musically, repeating and returning until words yield their meaning. As a girl, Sarah had never spent much time with boys. She found them mysterious. What did they want to talk about? What were women allowed to say? Disagreement was not permissible with her father. He disliked it. "Don't make a scene," her mother would say. What was permissible to say to boys? At times, the character's restraint felt to me like that of another era, but I relaxed into Robinson's masterly cadences and insights. After reading Leaving and her 2008 novel of addiction, Cost, I'd read any story she has to tell. I had hoped, because of my tender feelings for all involved, that this story would end with the same reassurances as Chekhov's. But, as it turns out, when Robinson says Tosca, he means Tosca. The ending is a bombshell, eminently discussable. This lithe novel engrosses. Robinson proves that writers can still evoke the silences and renunciations that thwart desire, and that stars still cross. This review was written by Amity Gage. She is the author of a New York Times notable book, Sea Wife, as well as three previous novels. Cocktails with George and Martha, Movies, Marriage, and the Making of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, by Philip Gefter. What a document dump. The most delicious parts of Cocktails with George and Martha, Philip Gefter's unapologetically obsessive new book about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the dark and stormy, oft-revived 1962 Broadway hit by Edward Albee that became a money-making movie and an eternal marriage meme, are diary excerpts from the screenwriter Ernest Lehman. Gefner calls the diary unpublished, but at least some of it surfaced in the turn-of-the-millennium magazine, Talk, now hard to find. That Lehman is no longer a household name, if he ever was, is one of showbiz history's many injustices. Before the thankless task of condensing Albee's 3-hour play for the big screen, on top of producing, he wrote the scripts for North by Northwest, arguably Hitchcock's greatest, and, with some help, Sweet Smell of Success. The latter was based on his experience copywriting for a press agent, which inspired a novelette in Cosmopolitan called Tell Me About It Tomorrow. Will someone please bring back the novelette? From beyond the grave in a production journal titled Fun and Games with George and Martha, housed at the Harry Ransom Center, Lehman dishes on working with Mike Nichols, the then darling of New York intellectuals, hired to direct his first Hollywood film, starring his famous, furiously canoodling friends, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. But first, Cocktails with George and Martha fans out like a deck of cards the backstory of the play, which initially featured Uta Hagen as Martha, the DeLulu-grown daughter of a New England college president, and Arthur Hill as George, her husband, an associate history professor whose career has stalled. Yes, they are named for the first couple of America. A younger married pair named Nick and Honey come over for the world's longest and most hellacious nightcap. Steeped in alcohol and analysis themselves, sophisticated audiences thrilled to the play's voyeurism and vulgar language, even as the Pulitzer Prize Committee got prudish, suspending the drama prize the year Wolfe was eligible. Gefter describes how another playwright, probably jealous of the box office returns, accused Albee, rather homophobically, of neuroticism and nihilism in the New York Times. If the theater must bring us only what we can immediately apprehend or comfortably relate to, Albee responded in one of cultural journalism's best mic drops, let us stop going to the theater entirely. Let us play patty cake with one another, or sit in our rooms and contemplate our paunchy middles. Casting Liz and Dick, then the world's biggest celebrity couple, in the movie after Jack Warner had promised Albee that Bette Davis and James Mason would do it also came with risk, and paunchy middles. The glamorous Taylor was instructed to gain 20 pounds. While Burton's delicious diaries barely mention the production, much of its agita is familiar from Mark Harris's recent and thorough biography of Nichols. but Gefter pulls in for a tighter focus. He's not quite the phrase-maker that Martha calls George. Locutions like garnering his own notoriety and actual lived behavior mush up an otherwise tight book, as does a scattered epilogue on other marriage movies. But he does, as George puts it, get to the marrow of male ego, rushing into new projects with hubris and jostling for posterity. Hacks only imitate, we artists steal, Nichols declared, binge-watching Truffaut and Fellini flicks in anxious preparation for the shoot. The novice director and the veteran writer bantered in the back of a limo to the airport about being jealous of each other's publicity. Nichols had been to Jacqueline Kennedy's apartment for lunch and would use her promised endorsement to prevent himself getting fired. Lehman, who contributed to The Sound of Music, which was thriving at the box office, had quietly arranged for a profile of himself in Cosmo. Dramatic alterations, like opening on a pair of fornicating dogs and making George and Martha's imaginary son real, were roundly rejected by Nichols, who also clashed with the seasoned cinematographer and composer assigned by the studio. He was determined to keep the movie in arty black and white, rather than commercial modern color, and wanted to hire Andre Previn or Leonard Bernstein to do the score. Mike likes them young and hip, Lehman sighed. Meanwhile, Burton tried to get the assistant director fired on his wife's behalf. It's rather like talking about changing one's housekeeper, isn't it? And worried that the project, like Nick, when he tries to have sex with Martha, would be a flop. He was mollified by a pond stocked with trout on location and a birthday present of Francis Bacon essays. Still, Lehman recorded the cast and crew were a discontented bunch, and, understating the case, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is not exactly a happy picture. Gefter, a former Times picture editor, has written formal biographies of the photographer Richard Avedon, Nichols's close friend, and the curator Sam Wagstaff. This is something different, a shot glass filled with one work that, alongside contemporaneous books like Richard Yates' novel Revolutionary Road and Betty Friedan's polemic The Feminine Mystique, showed how the cartoon versions of marriage, long served up by American popular culture, Doris Day movies, The Cleavers, etc., always came with a secret side of bitters. His interest in Woolf dates back to when he was 15 and, apparently the only teenager in America to read Playboy for the articles, encountered an interview with Nichols in his father's copy. Gefter peeks at the unpublished memoir of Gerard Malanga, a poet and Andy Warhol associate, to elaborate how George and Martha were at least in part inspired by Willard Moss and Marie Menken, teachers at Wagner College, about whom Warhol made a 1965 film called Bitch, which was recently screened at MoMA. He distills a lot of secondary material, including interviews published and unpublished, conducted by the critic Mel Gussow, also a longtime Timesman, Albee's friend and biographer. The playwright saw the phrase, "Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?" scrawled in dry soap on the mirror of a Greenwich Village bar around 1954, when he was an aspiring novelist, running with a crowd of talented bohemians. Woolf, which Gefter calls an existential provocation that serves up a range of fundamental truths about marital attachment, got its creator on the cover of Newsweek by 1963. Such a hall of mirrors is American culture that Martha's famous "What a dump" line quoted an unfamous one in a minor Betty Davis noir, Beyond the Forest. Davis, among the actresses lobbying to play Martha in the movie, then reclaimed it as a catchphrase for the rest of her years. Albee was a purist about his characters, repeatedly refusing the chance to revive Woolf on stage with gay male couples. Terrence McNally, an early boyfriend, thought he wrote like a composer. If so, though, there was a hint of jazz there. According to one actress who played Martha, Albee always said that Act 4 of the play was when the audience leaves the theater and the couples argue all the way home. Hey, It beats lying in bed with our laptops. This review was written by Alexandra Jacobs. She's a Times book critic and occasional features writer. The Secret History of Bigfoot, Field Notes on a North American Monster by John O'Connor. Why do Americans need Bigfoot? This question propels John O'Connor's Secret History of Bigfoot, a farrago of participatory journalism, anthropological speculation, pop culture parentheticals, and broadsides against Donald Trump that often seems stuck together by sap and tar, and is none the worse for it. John O'Connor, a journalism professor who has written about Antarctica and competitive eating, undertook his vision quest in 2020, when lies competed with microbes to lay Americans to waste. Officially, O'Connor was seeking Bigfoot, or at least the enduring wellspring of faith in Bigfoot, which struck him as just as elusive. But fleeing COVID doubled as a way for O'Connor to flee wokesters, as he calls the urban bourgeoisie of the pandemic era. Their pieties about masks and politics, coupled with their disdain for the supernatural, unaccountably irked him. Like a 49er cutting ties with the uptight Victorians, O'Connor sought instead wild places where men are men, go unmasked, and hope for moral redemption by Sasquatch. As O'Connor tramps around putative Bigfoot habitats, he's also fleeing his family. A stay-at-home dad in Cambridge, Mass., he became, during lockdown, a literal stay-at-home dad. His heretical hymn to child-free solitude is a breath of piney air. This was what passed for an afternoon in Washington. Porch beer, fresh-caught clams, butterflies in a currant-scented breeze. I loathed Boston just then. He echoes Karl Ove Nausgaard. Parenthood is a totalitarian regime that works, in O'Connor's words, by backing you into opposing corners that force you to view your children as the tiny miracles they're portrayed to be in the wider culture and as ongoing personal disasters. O'Connor's own struggle is between the cultural portrayal of miracles and the hard fact of personal disasters. But as deft as he is at observation, he can muster little cultural analysis where his own suffering is concerned. O'Connor savages himself as a white man with luxury problems, even roping in poor Bigfoot as a white man's self-ratifying pseudoscience that represents a transmogrification of indigenous legends. This is sad and frustrating. You want to see him imagine his own demons as vividly as he does society's. He's persuasive in arguing that the wider culture has thrown up Bigfoot as a worthy object of contemplation, a thirsty sop for national credulity. Referencing thinkers both familiar and obscure, O'Connor crafts a comprehensive popular history without getting bogged down enacting nerdy stunts. He is especially sure-footed in the terrain of writers, citing Thomas Bernard, Peter Matheson, and Henry David Thoreau. The insights he gleans from his literary and topographical surveys are often strikingly original. He's especially engaging when he compares Bigfooters to other kinds of trackers. The physical creeping through woodlands, often with guns, is, after all, what distinguishes Bigfooters from seance holders or QAnon adherents. When O'Connor recounts the vexed quest for the ivory-billed woodpecker, last seen in 1944, he casts a pathetic light on Bigfoot belief. Even academic ornithologists can be victims of cognitive bias. O'Connor's description of their propensity to hallucinate a white bill on a common pileated woodpecker is heartrending. The miracles of sunlight and birds in flight is not enough. We want angels. O'Connor quickly discovers that hearing a first-hand Bigfoot encounter is powerful. On an expedition in the Berkshires, the group leader tells of a petrifying 1992 sighting. He was, he says, never the same man. I came to love these rapturous accounts of sightings across America. It's this storytelling, popping eyes, blanched complexions, whispered astonishment that keeps Bigfoot alive, another hardy homegrown subculture. O'Connor lapses into laziness only when comparing Bigfoot fixation to Trumpism. Both, he says, are an expression of white anxiety and fear mixed with nostalgia for an imagined American past. A wallop of defeatism hits the prose. The same can and has been said of every culture at the moment of its colonization. And despite the book's considerable ingenuity, it isn't always easy to care about a malcontent who leaves his family during the pandemic and takes to the woods to own the libs. And however refined O'Connor's reading list, however iconic his approach, it's hard to forget that defiance isn't all fun and games. It can, taken too far, end in plots to kidnap governors or hang vice presidents. But O'Connor is affable in the extreme, and funny, and in Bigfoot he has found an object of desire that unites in real intimacy conservationists who long for wilderness and seekers who long for transcendence. The scenes of men talking, flexing their capacities for vulnerability and grief, are stunners. In these drumless drum circles, the same men who suspend disbelief about cryptozoology treat political conflict as though it didn't exist. That itself is haunting and verging on the paranormal. This review was written by Virginia Heffernan, who writes features for Wired. Her most recent book is Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. The Paleontologist by Luc Dumas. Why do characters in thrillers feel compelled to return to the scenes of their worst traumas? In Luc Dumas's The Paleontologist, Dr. Simon Neely foolishly takes a job at a struggling natural history museum, the very spot where his little sister, Morgan, disappeared on an outing with him when she was just 6 years old. With its secret rooms and piles of uncatalogued bones, not to mention its tendency to induce hallucinations in its employees, or are they? The museum feels less like Night at the Museum than Night of the Living Dead, set at Jurassic Park. Also, it's falling apart and hemorrhaging money because of the coronavirus pandemic. Simon is ordered to turn things around by mounting the dinosaur exhibition begun by his predecessor, Albert Mueller, who left under mysterious circumstances and whose descent into mental illness is chronicled in his increasingly unhinged research diaries. After receiving a series of threatening notes and having an unhappy visit with his mother, who lives in a mental institution, she rants, "They've been waiting for you to come back. Evil, nasty, terrible lizards." Simon has become a nervous wreck. When he sees a specimen in a diorama come briefly to life, he doesn't know what to think. It was as if the whole thing had never happened, the figment of a dark and disturbed imagination, Dumas writes. Sometimes the book veers off course a bit in its discussion of the library's funding problems, but it's erudite, atmospheric, and at times genuinely creepy. A book to be read in bed with the covers pulled tight. Half American, the heroic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad, by Matthew F. Delmont. Delmont explores the ways Black Americans experienced World War II differently from their white counterparts, from identifying the beginning of the war with Mussolini's 1935 invasion of Ethiopia to the over 1 million Black soldiers who fought abroad only to return home to the brutality of the Jim Crow regime. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.